Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Good morning, everybody. It's been a few weeks since I've done a live show, but I am Patrick Martins. This is the main course. It is Sunday, August... Hold on.
12th.
I have a very uppity guest today. No, I have a very... I'm really honored to have her on. I think I might have only had her on once before for a few minutes with a group of people. But we have the awesome Annabelle Saxelby. And
hello.
It's a real honor to have you. Well, Anne, I know you've been following a little bit the network, but we have a big party. Joe, are you in the studio? Engineered, produced, Joe?
I'm here, yes.
Joe Galarraga, who is blonde.
Yeah.
For all our viewers who cannot see into the studio, he is blonde today, which is cool. I like it. Why the change, Joe?
Oh, I just was feeling a little summery, a little bored, you know?
Yeah, change. I would do things like shave my head and my beard and things like that when I would feel like, you know, like you, you know, as a young buck, you know, running around New York City. Now, how's your rock band going? You're a lead singer of a rock band.
That's true. It's going well. I just played a show on Friday.
Now, didn't you get that Kieran told me that you got kicked off stage and that one of your bandmates threw a beer bottle against the wall and stuff? What happened?
That was just around the corner at a place I will not mention, but that happened. That's true.
It's a tough life out there. Well, we're going to have a pretty crazy party, although it won't involve throwing beers on the wall, but September 9th, Heritage Radio Network is having a members-only party, and it's going to be 200 people in the backyard of Roberta's, and it's $150 per person, but it includes a $60 membership, which gets you discounts at awesome shops like Saxelby Cheesemongers and the Heritage Meat Shop, but also a whole bunch of other discounts and special access. And the lineup is amazing, isn't it, Joe? Aaron got...
I know that Dave Arnold's doing cocktails.
Gramercy Tavern's going to be there.
Yeah.
Shauna Pacifico's Back 40 West is going to be there.
That's correct.
I can't say it's Peter Hoffman's. It is Shauna's restaurant. I'm sorry. I know that'll... I'm sure Peter's not listening, but... then we have... what else? We have all these big... Parish Hall is going to be doing fish in conjunction with Seat at Table. Roberta's is going to be doing a dish. There's a VIP tour for people that pay $250. Anyway, I'm really proud of them, and it's going to be the first ever, you know, quote-unquote 501c3 fundraiser for heritageradionetwork.org. So go to our website, buy tickets. It's really going to be awesome. Joe, I take it you're going to be there?
Of course.
Do you know what you're doing there? Has Aaron given you a task?
Not yet, because I think I'm going to be going straight from doing Curtis's show and then going to figure out what else to do, what needs to be done.
Hopefully, yeah. I'm going to dedicate my show that day to the actual party. So maybe Curtis will do the same and talk about like pop-up architecture or something. Well, it's a real honor to be back. It's been a slow summer. But, you know, after not doing the show for a few weeks, I needed to come back with a big guest. So thanks for being on, Ann.
Sure, no problem.
So now you started Saxelby Cheesemongers in 2006.
Yep.
And you were arguably either the first or the second all-American cheese shop in the entire country.
Yeah, I think we were the second. I think Beecher's in Seattle was the first. I think they started in 2004 or 2005.
Everybody knows that Seattle doesn't count and is really part of Canada. It's part of British Columbia.
No way. They're awesome. Kurt Dammeyer, the owner of Beecher's, he's a very cool guy.
Well, they claim to make the best grilled cheese or mac and cheese in the city, and it's just not. I mean, Casalula makes a better mac and cheese. I mean, they're well-intentioned, but to call it the best in the city, and they would be the first people to taste another one and be like, that one's better. But anyway, as far as this network is concerned, you were the first non-Canadian all-American cheese shop.
New York City cheese shop, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. Now, that was that's really big. I mean, I think people drop like, oh, that person's a genius, or oh, that person's, you know, started something. But to be the first all-American cheese shop or second in the country, I mean, that's pretty crazy to think that no one did that before. But I guess the cheeses just weren't good enough or available enough.
Yeah, I feel like it was a combination of a couple things. You know, American farmstead cheeses are usually more expensive than European imports, just because of the scale that cheese is produced in Europe and because of different subsidies that dairy farmers and cheesemakers might get over there that they don't get over here. Mm-hmm. And so I think the money thing is one reason why some people, you know, that people might not have done it before. But then I think, yeah, the other thing is availability of a concentration of great cheeses in you know, in America or even in this region, you know, because we decided to go with just the Northeast in the end. And 10 years ago, you know, half the cheesemakers that I buy from didn't even exist. Mm. So that's another thing. And then I think there's just the, you know, the logistical nightmare of getting all of these cheeses from all these small farms to, you know, one location. Because
isn't that just FedEx though?
Well, it started that way for us. But you know, even getting cheesemakers on the phone, you know, can be a pain in the butt from time to time. You know, we call and leave messages and would just kind of hope that people got them and sent them back or sent us some cheese. But you know, farmers and cheesemakers are really busy, and so that added, you know, sort of legwork is something that I feel like not a lot of people are equipped to do.
Mm-hmm, for sure. So you're company grew in 2006. It started just as a small retail outlet at the Essex Street Market, and now has grown to encompass wholesale and a kind of satellite spot in conjunction with Daniel Ballou in front of Lincoln Center at L'Épicerie. So, you know, and you're really a household name. You're on the board of the American Cheese Society. I mean, people know you. You have a radio show. So how much pressure do you feel to continue and grow, both for yourself, for your workers, for the cheesemakers you represent, for the investors who helped start? Like, how much pressure is that? Because it is Saks, called Saxby Cheesemongers. It's not called like some crazy name. It's actually your name on it. So that must be a lot of pressure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I definitely feel like, you know, especially in a city like New York, people kind of grow and expand their businesses at really rapid rates. You know, you see somebody open a successful restaurant and all of a sudden they have four or five more and you're like, whoa, how'd they do that? So I think we definitely want to keep growing. And I think from when we started to where we are now, you know, we've you know, gotten exponentially bigger and are able to sell a lot more cheese for the farms that we work with, which is, you know, the basic goal. And but I feel like, you know, our next steps, we just want to do the right thing and kind of consider everything carefully, because once you make a choice to do something mm-hmm. else, you know, then it's hard to go back on it. So I feel like we want to open, you know, we want to continue to grow our wholesale business, continue to grow our mail order business, which, as you know, is pretty tiny. But I think we can do a better job with that, and then eventually have another store somewhere in the city.
So why was the cheese shop open? I mean, was it to help cheesemakers or was it to help Americans? I mean, what is the single raison d'etre for Saxby Cheesemongers?
Well, I guess, you know, when I like wrote like my business plan, you know, I downloaded a template of a business plan from the SBA website, which is the Small Business Administration. And I decided that our mission would be, you know, to be the bridge between the farmer and the end consumer, which for me, I think is still the most important thing. Just taking all that knowledge that the farmer has about how he or she raises their animals and how they make the cheese and why they do things the way that they do, and really being able to communicate as much of that as possible to chefs and people who come to the store. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, that's still the number one thing.
So you're a bridge. That's a very nice way of putting it. Well, just to give our listeners, I think a lot of people, they think they know, but they don't. 99% of the people don't know what the hell's going on with the sustainable food world. They know the name, they know where they should shop, and they know a lot, but they don't necessarily know how things work. So without boring our listeners, give us a week in the life. I mean, take us through an average Monday to Friday. Like, what essentially happens on Mondays and on Tuesdays? I think our listeners would like to know what goes into actually running it, not just, you know, oh, I like the taste of this cheese.
Sure, sure. Well, yeah, I'll try not to be boring about it. So Monday morning, as you know, I wake up way too early usually and
write the weekly email.
Write our weekly email, okay. Yes. Which you know, I've been doing since we started. So that so I write the weekly email and schedule that to be sent out later in the day. Then when I get into the office around 9 o'clock, then start to place orders for the week. With cheesemakers, yep. Me and Sarah Main, who's our store manager, we take care of all the ordering.
How do you know what to order? I mean, it's enough. You have to guess what the wholesale and retail business is going to be for the week and order accordingly, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I used to do it all just by feeling and by gut. But as the business has grown, that proved to not be a very effective way of doing it.
And did you order too much or too little?
Both, you mm-hmm. know, and it's like you can never guess, you know, it always surprises you. The thing that you think you're really going to need, you end up having too much of. And the thing that you kind of are conservative on is the thing that everyone wants. And
so what did you develop, a formula or something?
No, we just we take inventory once a week. And then we also print out a sales report that shows the sales of each cheese for the past 4 weeks. So we can kind of take an average and then kind of know, you know, if we're going into summer, which is a slower time, we might order a little bit less than what we've been selling on average. But if it's we're going into the fall, we might order a little bit more.
And how many cheese makers are you calling on an average week?
I mean, on the busy weeks, I'll probably call like 20 cheesemakers myself, and Sarah will call between 15, probably 10 and 15. And on the not so busy weeks, you know, we might call 10 people mm-hmm. each, 15 people each.
And do these cheesemakers look to you to move certain amounts, or is it just you place an order and order what you need, and if you don't order 1 week, that's okay with them?
No, I mean, I feel like most people, we kind of try to establish, you know, some protocol of what we're going to be ordering, because their production's kind of limited, and it's kind of a privilege that they sell to us in a lot of occasions. So we want to, if we commit to ordering a certain amount of product, we want to really do that. Mm-hmm. So we try to have conversations with people constantly about, you know, are we doing a good job? Are we not doing a good job? You know, do they need to move stuff, you know, certain cheeses more than we have been?
What are your strategies?
Are they low on certain cheeses and we have to communicate with all of our chefs that they won't see it for a couple months? You know, there's a lot of information that goes back and forth.
How much power do you have to push a cheese? I mean, can you convince a retail customer to buy a cheese that you need to move? Or can you convince a chef? I mean, can you
if
rely
the cheese
on
is
that?
Good? Yeah, 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 yeah. I mean, if the cheese, you know, and we've been in this situation, as I'm sure everybody else is. Sometimes you hold on to cheese a little bit too long, and that's kind of been one of my hardest lessons to learn. That even if it sucks, and even if you have to take a loss, and even if you know someone's hard work has been wasted because the cheese is overripe, mm-hmm. it's better not to sell that cheese because, you know, the person that you're talking to, whether it's a chef or a customer, they're relying on you to give them good cheese. So, you know, that's our responsibility to make sure we're always giving people the best cheese.
Well, that implies that you have some sell bad cheese, but we'll get to that later. So what else happens on Monday, and then take us through the rest of the week?
So Monday basically is ordering. We do a staff lunch in the middle of the day, but, you know, making sure that we get all the orders in and then just kind of catching up on stuff for the week. Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday are our biggest days for deliveries.
Wholesale.
Okay. Yeah. So we sell Salvatore Brooklyn Ricotta, which has become a really big part of our business. Betsy Devine, the cheesemaker, was nice enough to give us the exclusive distribution of her cheese in New York. So on the days that we deliver Salvatore, we've got a lot of work to do. So generally on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays between 8 and noon, I'm just, you know, either cutting and wrapping cheese, on the phone with chefs talking about, you know, troubleshooting their orders in case they've ordered something we don't have, mm-hmm. or if they don't quite meet our delivery minimum, or, you know, any number of things.
What is the delivery minimum?
$100.
Okay.
For a restaurant. And then in the afternoons, it's just kind of, again, catching up with everybody, you know,
emails,
calling chefs, making sure that we're keeping tabs on what cheeses are going out of season so we can organize tastings and trainings with people, you know, if they need to put new things on the menu.
How many wholesale accounts do you have in the city? In the five boroughs?
We have a list of over like 200 restaurants. Wow. I don't think that we sell to all of them as consistently. I would say we probably sell to around like 100 mm-hmm. pretty consistently. But yeah.
So that's Wednesday, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays.
Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. Yep. And then Wednesdays, I'm in the shop. So
Essex Street Market, Essex and Delancey.
Yep. Wednesdays and actually and Thursdays too. So I'm not at the cave on Thursdays, but Wednesday is kind of a slow day for us. Kind of a day to catch our breath and start to. You know, prepare for the busy end of the week. Mm-hmm. Thursday is the day that we receive all of our product coming in from this cold storage facility in Queens called Larkin. So Thursdays, you know, we have our busy morning getting orders ready. And then in the afternoon, we're checking in huge amounts of cheese and making sure that they're in good shape and that they're labeled properly. And
so you're working so hard. Is your goal, I mean, how are you going to judge success after doing this for 25 or 35 years? I mean, would the goal be to diminish the sale of craft singles in America? Or is it just to run a successful independent business in New York City? You know, how are you going to judge yours? Or where would you like, yeah, how will you judge success?
That's a good question. That's a hard question. I think that I would judge success in just, you know, being able to be the best at what I originally set out to do, which is, you know, if the farms need people to buy their cheese, then we want to be the people who can do it. And so I would say success for me would look like selling more cheese from the farms who can produce more and who want to sell more, you know, doing right by our small farms who just want, you know, who trust us because we take good care of their cheese and make sure that it's represented in a special, smaller collection rather than a huge list of products.
Are there new farmers coming up?
Well, then the last thing that I would say would be a real definition of success for me is being able to help launch certain new products that are coming online and developing those relationships with the farmers from the very start. Like when they're just getting into the business, they trust us to do the representation of their products in New York. And then 20 years later, be like, oh yeah, we've been working together since the beginning. That would be cool.
Is that happening? I mean, is there a real renaissance of new cheesemakers and dairies around the country? Or is that just more an idea that people wish was happening? But I mean, are you constantly getting calls?
Yeah, no, I mean, not constantly, but you know, we have the opportunity to, recently the two that have come up, there's a farm in, they're both upstate New York, actually. One's in a town called Cazenovia, and the farm's called Meadowood Farms. And the cheesemaker is Veronica Pedraza, who used to actually work for us at the shop. Mm-hmm. She's making awesome sheep's milk cheeses. And she, called me and was like, I want you to sell my cheese in New York. And so she's working with us to get her cheeses out there, which is a huge compliment. And so she's producing relatively a small amount right now, but as they continue to grow, hopefully we can, you know, really honor that relationship and make it work. And then the other one is a farm in Hartwick, New York called Ole's Farm. And they make really fabulous butter, which is still something that's hard to find. There's not a lot of, you know, good, you know, farm butter to be had. So they want to work with us to get their butter into New York, into restaurants. And we really want to help them with that.
So are craft singles bad?
Yeah.
They're bad.
They're bad.
Are they evil? Are they unhealthy? I mean, why are they bad? I mean, I want to get a little hate out of you.
I'd have to look at the ingredients label, but I think if you looked at the ingredients label, it'd be pretty obvious.
You'd be angry.
That it wasn't cheese, you know? It's basically, I think Kraft Singles started off as, you know, basically like cheddar that was kind of ground up and reconstituted with certain chemical elements that would make it kind of that smooth, weird, melty texture. There's also a lot of, there's some sugar in Kraft Singles and just stuff that doesn't belong in cheese. Cheese has four ingredients, milk, culture, rennet, and salt. And that's it.
That's it.
Yeah.
What is the state of artisanal cheeses in places like Arkansas and Idaho and Nebraska?
It's growing everywhere.
Even in places like that.
Even in places like that. I met a farmer in Idaho or who has a who has his farm in Idaho at the American Cheese Society conference and making really awesome cheddar cheese. You know, making cheese from the milk of his own animals, but also helping out his neighbors who have a dairy farm and were struggling. And I feel like people are just realizing that cheese is a really good way for them to stay in dairy farming, which is a passion for a lot of people, and make money, because you can't really do that on the commodity market right now.
So if the best people who you most respect in the cheese for their palate, if they were to all get together, four or five of them, and pick the top 25 cheeses in the world, How many would be American?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I want to
like
say
eight.
Yeah, no, I want to say like eight, you know, definitely. I don't think it would be half. I don't think it would be more than half, but I think we get a solid, you know, a solid quarter in there, you know, quarter or third.
Really? In the whole world? So you would be beating age-old traditions in France and Italy? I mean, 25. I mean, there's probably 2,000 types of cheeses made in Italy. So you would beat almost all of them, you know, like I say, except for 12 or 15. I mean, it's just an interesting question to look at it that way.
Yeah.
Pecorinos, Parmigiano. Well, Parmigiano-Reggiano would be number one.
Well, according to you.
Well, no, isn't it?
According to the French, it would be Comté.
Oh, okay.
According to the British, it might be cheddar. You know, there's a lot of subjective stuff. But yeah, no, that's interesting. It would be a really tough battle. But I want to say between a quarter and like a third of the cheeses could be okay. American.
What type of cheeses are we best at?
Whole range of stuff. Okay. I feel like, you know, Europe is interesting because cheese is developed in certain regions over hundreds of years because of all these weird, of all these super specific socioeconomic things. My favorite two examples are Camembert and Comté, which I learned about in Paul Kinstead's book. But Comté was made up in the mountains by these like big burly guys who would lead their cows up there in the summertime because the valleys were being farmed and the mountain pastures were full of grass and free of charge for them to use. They would collect their milk in a communal facility and make giant wheels of cheese that were relatively low in moisture so that they could be stored for a long, long time. And then they'd bring those cheeses back down the mountain to eat in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. Camembert was made by French housewives, basically, in Normandy because they only had one or two cows at a time. And so they would need to collect a lot of milk over the course of a couple days to make cheese. And so that milk would get acidified, which is ideally suited to Camembert-style cheese, which has a lot of acid in the curd before it's molded. And then they would take, you know, they would make tiny wheels of cheese that then they could bring to the markets on the weekend and sell. So those things happened out of necessity. But American cheesemakers make cheese that they like. They basically have had the luxury of choosing between the world's best cheeses and say, oh, I want to make a cheese that's like a Camembert or like a Comté.
They have no baggage.
So there's a lot more experimentation.
How do you tell a cheesemaker no, your cheese, this is bad?
I don't ever want to be really negative.
But do you sell cheeses that you don't like?
No.
Okay.
No. So, I mean, I guess I try to put it into context for people because I feel like a lot of people who are making cheese, you know, they spend a lot of time on their farms. They're really tied to what they do day in and day out. And they might not have the full range of context of what cheese is available out there and the level of quality that's out there. So we just try to tell them, you know, what's good about their cheese, what we think they could improve on. And if we don't carry it, more likely than not, it's just because we already have something that's kind of like it, but that we've been, you know, that we've been selling for longer, and then we need to honor the relationship that we have with that producer.
What is there certain cheese maker personality stereotypes? I mean, are they, they obviously are hard workers, but I mean, is there a certain characteristic of person that is attracted to cheese or vice versa, or that attract, you know?
I think, well, they're all like slightly crazy in a good way, because you kind of have to be to, you know, be willing to devote your life to doing that.
To what? To milking or to being in a laboratory and making sure temperatures are correct?
I mean, making cheese entails so much. Yeah, most people share the duties between like a husband and a wife or partners. You know, one person will take care of the animals, the other will take care of, you know, the cheese making stuff. But I guess, so, you know, you have to be willing to work your butt off, but then the other thing is that cheesemakers tend to be really, they're sticklers for detail. People who are meticulous, people who are detail oriented, people who are like, you know, super, you know, clean, people who enjoy doing repetitive tasks.
They're like pastry people.
The pastry people make great cheesemakers. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They both are after dinner things. So it's funny. It's like after a certain unifying energies there.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
So how has your role changed over the years, both in the cheese movement and at the shop? I mean, you started in 2006, and now we're 6 years later.
Well, I guess, yeah, at the shop, you know, it started out me just, you know, I was the only employee. I worked there 6 days a week, open to close, and I just did, you know, everything. And now, you know, I'm lucky I have a business partner, Benoit Brayal, who's great. So we can kind of share, you know, the administrative stuff and the big decision-making stuff that comes along with running a business. And we've got a bunch of really talented employees, Alex Zinkowski, who's our cave manager, and Sarah Main, who's our store manager. So I think I've been able to do a little, I still love to be at the shop. And I still really love being able to just be behind the counter and help customers. But I think I've started to move more into a role of, you know, the sourcing and the buying is like really important. So I've tried to focus more of my energies on that. Mm-hmm. And then also on wholesale, on just developing relationships with chefs.
Very good. Very good. And I guess my last question, you're on the board of the American Cheese Society. If you could tell some of our listeners and cheesemakers who are listening, you know, about some of the things that they're doing to, you know, improve the state of cheese in the U.S.
Yeah. The American Cheese Society is a great organization. It was started in the 80s by this guy, Kazakowski, who was a dairy professor, I believe in New York State. I should look it up. Frank Kazakowski. And it was really just a small grassroots organization for people who are making cheese and needed answers on you know, how to troubleshoot this or that, you know, and just feedback as well. Now it's grown into an organization. We have like 1,460 members, I think. And
what's membership cost?
Membership costs, it's not cheap. I think for an individual, and don't quote me on this, I'd have to look on the website, it's like $190.
Wow.
But being a member, and you know, now being on the board, I have a better understanding of all the things that ACS does. They offer tons of benefits. They offer informational webinars on everything from how to develop a HACCP plan for your business to, you know, online marketing strategies for retailers. Lots of informational webinars that you can access when you're a member. The annual conference is amazing. It brings together thousands of, you know, cheese dorks from the world over to attend seminars, do tastings, do meet the cheesemaker events, and then has a big competition element where people submit their cheeses to be judged and scored. So it's kind of a, you know, sets the bar in a certain way for whose cheeses are really, you know, performing well. I just think it's an important organization for like it's like a fraternity of cheese lovers, everyone from consumers to cheesemakers to, you know, regulators even. We're starting to welcome them, you know, try to get them more involved in the discussion. And that's another important element of what the ACS is trying to do, help cheesemakers in this climate, because over the past couple of years, the FDA has really started to crack down more on small-scale cheesemakers. And if we're going to survive as an industry, we really need to have our shit together, basically. And ACS is really facilitating that through bringing regulators into our conference and into our sort of circle, and also providing more resources for cheesemakers to become better at what they do.
Are they ever going to change the 60-day rule or no? For raw milk? Probably not, right?
It seems doubtful right now, but Canada changed it. Hmm. So, you know, we can look to the Canucks for inspiration.
Considering how much cheese you ate at the recent event, I mean, you look great. You're really, you know, holding it together. And I know it's a challenge to go out and eat at all these restaurants. And, you know, you look beautiful and healthy.
Oh, thank you very much. That's
so
nice.
So if you could just take us out, our sponsor is White Oak Pastures, and I'd like you to take us out the way Will would, because you do a great, Anne is a great imitator of people. I don't know if people know that, but she does old people well, young people. She's very, very funny. Also, for our listeners, it's saxobycheese.com.
Yep. That's
and
correct.
Then you can also probably link to the American Cheese Society, or just Google American Cheese Society and look into that. But they're two great organizations. And Saxelby has a mail order company. So if you want to taste the best of the Northeast cheeses and you live in a different city, you know, feel free to just go to the website and get it delivered, overnight shipping.
Cool.
So what would Will say about this interview?
Well, I think, and I mean this with the greatest amount of respect, that White Oak Pastures is really a strong supporter of the Heritage Radio Network.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you.
Well, thanks very much, Anne. And we're going to take a break. You're going to hear how close Anne's imitation was of Will as he talks. And we're going to come back with another guest who's very similar to Anne in personality, Mike Edison.
You're listening to I'm Not Gonna Cry by Sharon Jones and Dap Kings.
White Oak Pastures is a 146-year-old multi-generational family farm that works in cooperation with nature to produce artisan meat that is safe, healthy, nutritious, and good to eat. Without fail, we ensure that our production practices are economically practical, ecologically sustainable, and that the animals are always humanely treated. We never falter in our determination to conduct our business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
Well, we are back. We're with another host. Anne has a great show called Cutting the Curd, which airs on Monday afternoons at 5, I believe. And now Mike is on, and he has a show called The Mike and Judy Show.
Hey, it's just like old times, Patrick.
Remember just when, like old times.
Remember when we used to work together all the time?
Can we talk about the new show name or no?
No, let's hold off on that. We'll have some big news
pretty
soon.
Full of surprises.
I'm full of surprises. I got lots of news. I have a political satire coming out. Did I tell you about this?
No. Well, it's an e-book.
It's going to be an e-book. It's available. It'll be available in September. It's called Bye Bye, Miss American Pie, and I'm really excited about this. It's always been one of my lifetime goals to write a political satire.
Now, what does that mean exactly? I mean, I know what that means.
To have a goal? You don't know what it is to have a goal?
But what what are you satiring? Just politics? I mean, this is like that movie, the Will Ferrell movie, Campaign?
Which I haven't seen yet. I think the Will Ferrell thing is probably falls closer to parody than actual satire, but my book is based, inspired anyway, sort of on Candide and Terry Southern's Candy, which itself was a rip on Candide. It's a satire of the election process and the campaign. What happens is, in Bye Bye Miss American Pie, a female senator, an attractive female senator, gets caught fucking her pool boy. Her attractive pool boy, the illegal immigrant. And of course, the opposition, the conservative opposition, thinks this is going to tank her campaign. And she has to go on TV to apologize, like we've seen so many politicians do.
Nixon, and was he the first?
I don't know if he was the first, but...
he was a big one.
Yeah, I don't know, I don't think he actually apologized. He said, I am not a crook. He resigned, but I don't...
No, well, he... Well, I mean, when he was, I think, a senator in California or something, he did something bad.
Well, you know, he was a sore loser. You know, he had the whole Checker speech, then there was the... you won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore speech. I don't know if he was actually ever contrite for any of his behavior.
So you made this up about this woman and her bull boy?
Yes, I made this up. It's what writers do.
But it's what realistically would happen if such a thing happened.
Well, I don't know if such a thing happened. But what happens is, in this book, she goes on TV being told to be contrite, apologize. But what she does is she does exactly the opposite. She says, I got mine. And now go out and get yours, America, because you know you want it. Okay? And that night, everyone in America gets laid. She rekindles a new American sexual revolution.
It's like the end of World War II, when everyone was just having sex. This woman...
It's a crazy thing. All of a sudden, sex is the word, and the campaign sort of spins out of control on both sides just to keep up with each other.
That'd be great for the Mike and Judy show.
And it's the Mike and Judy show.
Well, you would have so much content if everyone was just just having sex like crazy.
Yeah.
So now I heard you were very upset when you walked in because of the state of blueberry muffins today. Can you tell our listeners what
it's
angered you?
It's a fucking American tragedy. It is. It's
Where
nothing
are the
short.
Blueberries?
Where are the blueberries? I bought a blueberry muffin, a blueberry banana muffin, actually, today. And where is that rich, gorgeous purple vein? See, I can make anything sound dirty, right? Mm-hmm. Of blueberries in my muffin.
What, do they just have not enough blueberries in there?
I don't know, not enough blueberries. When's the last time you had a blueberry muffin?
Well, I stopped.
Why?
Now I know why. There's no blueberries
in
there. I
know. It's a paucity of blueberries. It's a tragedy. It was tragic. I almost cried.
Very tragic. Well, that's good to know. Our listeners should know that. Now, I see you're open to American...
Well, I'm reading The Post, my favorite...
Your favorite newspaper.
My favorite right-wing hate sheet. And I'm seeing here, right here, Whitney's thing on Whitney Houston. She wanted the movie Sparkle to redeem her, but drugs were more powerful than her dreams. Now, that's good copywriting, and I intend to discuss this today on the Mike and Judy Show.
Well, tell us about the Mike and Judy Show. What is what's the story? What are the future episodes? How's it going? I mean, tell our listeners.
You tell me, boss.
You're like I say, you're one of the top 30 rated shows on the network.
The Mike and Judy Show has been going great. We're really lucky to be part of this whole heritage thing. No, really, we feel that way. We feel very humbled and privileged and flattered that we get to be part of this whole thing. And well, you know, I got in kind of early with you, right?
Yeah, we were co-hosting together,
and that was great.
Where did we first meet? Through Joe, I think. Bastianich.
No, I think it was just out here at Roberta's through Brandon and Chris and those guys.
At one point, they wanted you to write the Roberta's story.
Chris was making a pitch to be writer in residence, which I should probably see if I can rekindle that.
Yeah, then you would get free toppings.
Yeah,
on your pizza.
Toppings on my pizza. Yeah.
You get a pizza from us, and then the toppings from Chris.
Man, how good is the food here?
Yeah, no, Roberta's is very good. Have you been to Blanca?
Yeah, it's above my pay grade. Heritage isn't paying me enough.
Oh, really?
Just yet. But hopefully, if everybody becomes a member, you see, see the way I segued that?
Yes,
you know, pitch
exactly.
For money?
$60 for membership. So tell us, what else is newsworthy in Mike's life? I mean, where do you get this ebook? Do you get paid to do an ebook?
If everyone buys it, the short answer is yes.
Well,
you know, the ebook revolution is a good thing, and it's a great thing for writers, and especially for something like this. I had actually wanted to write this 4 years ago before the last election. I had the idea, and there really wasn't a format to support a short piece of work. It's too long for a magazine, and what magazine really wants to give up that kind of real estate to me? I mean, I'm an author with a decent track record, but I'm not enough of, you know, not enough to, you know, buy some pages in Vanity Fair where it might be seen. It's 15,000 word story. It's barely a novella.
Quality of the work lessened than if you needed to publish it? I mean, not your work notwithstanding, but because they're like, sure, make an ebook. Who cares? Or does it still take a big investment and everything to get an ebook?
You know, it's a double edged sword because part of it, the democracy of the internet that anybody can publish on it, kind of dilutes the pond for those people who are actually really good at it, because, you know, just anybody can push the button and send it up. It's the same way with the music business as well. It's just too easy and too quick, and there's no barrier to entry anymore. So anybody who just writes something, sure, they can upload it. Amazon makes it very easy. There are a few different self-publishing programs. Hopefully, because I've written a few books and I have some fans and I'm fortunate enough to have a little bit of a following, you know, I've got a leg up, one hopes. But it's a great format. It's, you know, it's going to cost $1.99 and push a button, you know, and have 30 minutes of, like, you know, laughs and entertainment and hopefully an elucidating commentary on the absurdity of this culture.
So tell our listeners who want to, like, oh, I'm a good writer, I want to become a writer when I grow up or convert into writing, what is the life of a freelancer? I mean, is it about you going out and working it and meeting someone and being like, hey, I'd write a book? Or is it your agent that finds it and says, hey, this is the book for Mike? I mean, how does it work?
It works in a few different ways, and I'm fortunate enough that I do have a great agent, but that didn't come easily either. You know, Judy McGuire, co-host of the Mike and Judy Show, is also a working writer. And when I say working writer, I mean we've written everything. Judy writes marketing copy, you know, about soap and deodorant and toothpaste. I've done deodorant copy. I wrote books about hockey for Canadian Club. I've written, you know, press releases for timeshares on sailboats. You know, at $300 a pop, you take that job. You don't say no.
Right.
And that's not as good as getting a gig writing a real book. I've written lots and lots of pornography. Mm-hmm. I've written.
Well, porn's a big industry. That's how a lot of writers get their start, because they need so much stuff written for that industry. And it's so big, right?
Me and Walt Whitman. Well, it used to be the case. Well, you'd be surprised how many people wrote smut early on.
Well, it got them jobs.
It got us paid. Kept the lights on.
And it allowed you to get like your quote-unquote SAG card for freelance. I mean, they were like, this guy's written 10 books or 10 movies.
Well,
or
you know, it's not really, it's kind of hard to make the leap from porn into something legit, because you can't really put it on the CV. But what it does is it gets your motor running. I mean, I always found, personally, writing porn meant you had to write a lot, and I had to make deadlines, and it was a way to, you know, meet people also. But definitely working for, like, you know, skanky porn magazines didn't help me get, you know, well, it's yes and no, because I actually write about my experience writing as part of my thing, and I later wrote a history of men's magazines. But really, what are you going to tell the person at Vanity Fair that you've been writing, you know, Penthouse letters? They don't really care. Except here's the thing. Penthouse letters back in the day used to pay a lot of money.
Yeah. And it was probably, and Playboy was always a good magazine.
Playboy is different, because, you know, and also, you know, Penthouse, if you write feature stories, Penthouse was a great magazine. I talk about this in my latest book, Dirty, Dirty, Dirty. Available wherever better books are sold, and Amazon and whatnot. That Penthouse was one of the surprises of working on this book, was to rediscover how great a magazine Penthouse actually was through the 70s and the 80s.
And then it stopped.
It was a fantastic magazine. The journalism and the photography was 10 times steamier than anything Playboy ever did. Mm-hmm. This really
Not a big Hugh Hefner fan.
No, fuck him. You know how I feel about Hugh Hefner.
But you like the Penthouse guy, and you like the Hustler guy and all that?
Well,
I mean, they were,
you know,
better at what they did?
No, I don't know that they're better. Everybody certainly has their flaws. But my problem with Hugh Hefner is that I think he's a duplicitous, women-hating creep. You know, and he's a closet queen, too. And I always say I applaud his bisexuality. I just wish he had enough balls to come out of the closet and, you know, and tell us really who the hell he is. Because I think it's just kind of creepy the way he parades around his mansion. You know, Patrick, if I wore my pajamas to the radio show every day, what would you say?
It would be awkward. We'd probably have to airlift you in so you wouldn't walk through Roberta's.
You know? And that's the thing with Hefner. He denies being a pornographer. He says Playboy is not about sex. He wants to have it both ways. And, you know, no, he wants to pretend that he's this nice old man and not a pornographer, which I think is highly duplicitous. It's bullshit. I don't like that kind of bullshit, at least with Bob Guccione, with Larry Flint, my old friend Al Goldstein. What you see is what you get. I mean, they're pigs, but they'll cop to it.
Yeah. Now, poor Al. Is he still alive and crazy? I mean, do you ever go visit him?
I'm due for a visit. He's some sort of assisted care facility in Brooklyn, not too far from here.
Is he still together?
Actually.
I mean,
yeah, he was pretty lucid the last couple times I saw him. I was really happy when I saw him. When my book came out, Dirty, 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 I went to see him. At the time, he was in a VA hospital. I mean, thank God Al was a veteran. He signed up for Korea because he has health care. And he needs it. He's in terrible shape.
Yeah, he was never that healthy looking on Channel J.
Yeah, the guy who treated his diabetes with pints of Haagen-Dazs. That's not part of Obamacare.
No, that's not.
When I gave him my book, and he sort of teased me, you know, he said, oh, Mike, you know, you're a nice guy. I really like you, but I'm not going to read this thing, you know. My friend Larry Sloman Ratso told me a couple months ago that Al was bragging about my book.
Really? So he did?
Yeah,
read
he was
it.
Just that's just Al putting me on. He's like, "Fuck you." You know?
Now I always ask. I actually did a search for this. Who did you say was by far and away the best wrestler of all time?
Well, Ric Flair generally considered the greatest wrestler of all time.
Ric Flair. Because I looked at all these top tens because I was trying to find the name of who it was, and they had Hulk Hogan as number one.
Hulk Hogan, as anyone in the know,
he's the Hugh Hefner of wrestling.
Is the most. he is despicable in so many ways. And poor Hulk Hogan, for my own long time, I used to feud with him openly in the wrestling magazine I used to run, talk about hack writing. But boy, I loved that job. That was great, running a wrestling magazine in the 80s. You know, pre-internet stuff, right?
Oh my God, pre-internet. I mean, everybody was religion. I mean, Jimmy Fly Snuka, Junkyard Dog, the Beverly Hillbillies.
That was the golden era of wrestling, you know? It really was the Lunchbox days, the nascent WrestleMania days.
It was just post, like, the movie The Wrestler, and it was pre this modern era where there's all these different divisions. It was where Vince McMahon was getting body slammed.
What was
the name of the announcer who would interview the people?
He made his power play back then, McMahon. That was the whole thing. I mean, I always say McMahon is a genius because he is the one who saw the implications of cable television. He realized mm-hmm. that he could take a local show and the whole country could see it.
Well, ESPN, same thing. Right. So he was
ESPN
just like
started
that.
Out like right, very
yeah, they
the
understood
shoestring.
What a satellite was, and they jumped on it.
That's right, and obviously ESPN now is one of the you know most successful stories in the history of television.
Although very interesting, I noticed that the NBC does not allow them, or maybe it's the Olympics, doesn't allow them to use video. So all their sports footage of Usain Bolt or of Americans winning gold medals was all photographs.
Right. Well, NBC owns the Olympics. They paid a lot of money for that, right?
And now they're starting their own 24-hour you know, sports station. Yeah. It's just interesting. Most footage of sports is shown, but not to ESPN.
Well, it's the only reason I still have my cable box at all. $60 a month I pay to Time Warner, who I'm in this imaginary adversarial relationship with because I hate them, you know?
Yeah.
What do I fucking get for my $60? I don't watch it. You know, I can barely watch Bravo anymore.
But it's nice to know that you can. You know, it's like having a car. You don't always use it, but it's nice to know you can just jump in and drive somewhere.
Yeah, well, I live in Manhattan, so I don't have one of those either. But I think the thing is, though, Patrick, that the internet, I can stream everything now. You have an Apple TV box
yeah,
or a Roku
not the
box.
Same.
You know,
you're going on to some, you know, Polish website to try to watch a basketball
No,
game.
But that's going to change. I'm going to say the cable box is going to be the past, and the internet really is going to take over. I mean, they'll figure it out. They'll have no choice but to figure
they
it
probably
out.
Have already figured it out, but they're going to sparse it out very slowly so people have to spend tens of thousands of dollars like every 3 years to, you know, get the new technology. Well, any new news, Mike, before we cut away? I mean, you're going to be on
minutes. That's right. Well, the Mike and Judy show today at 2 o'clock.
Who do you have on?
you
don't even know?
Kevin and Ariel, two great writers. We have a lot of writers on our show, mm-hmm. and you know, Judy always says we're the bastard stepchild of this whole operation.
Well, no,
she's still mad at you. You know that.
Why? Well, I always say she's mad at me.
Because you didn't put the Mike and Judy show in all your fundraising material.
Well, now
because we're like the X-rated show.
Just as we were trying to get nonprofit status, we figured, you know, but now that we are, we will. And I just want to say, I think that the group of people that you bring to the network are, I've always said, one convert is equal to 100 members of the choir. And you are all convert people. I mean, most of the people that come to you is not because they want to eat organic heritage meats, but because they listen to the station, they get that message. So I think you're expanding the sustainable reach more than most shows, even mine, which is really a great show.
Your show is great, and I agree. Well, you know me. I'm down with the cause.
Joe, stop laughing.
You know, I'm down with the cause, so is Judy.
Hold on. Joe's laughing too hard. Joe. Okay, he's back.
You know, the thing about food is you put it in your mouth.
Yes. You got to eat it. Well, a lot of your work was about that same theme in the past. Well, thanks so much. And I mean, I'm going to say one day we're going to come out with a book together. That's my prediction.
I think we should. We definitely should do that.
I mean, what should we call it?
I think it should be some sort of manifesto.
Yeah, it should be a manifesto, although I don't think manifesto is a great marketing word in the U.S.
Well, it's a beautiful day for a revolution, Patrick.
But you are one of the top 200-300 people I've met since starting the network, and it's an honor to have you come on. And thanks for signing up to become a member. Thanks to
Absolutely.
Our listeners.
It's kind of pay to play here at Heritage, but right on.
Please become a member if you're listening. Thanks to White Oak Pastures for sponsoring and to Joe for engineering and producing. We will be back in 2 weeks and then go straight through till Christmas.
And please stay tuned. The Mike and Judy Show coming out at 2 p.m.
Thank you so much. Bye now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.